Tonight on Arena, we bring you the very best of our recent interviews with writers. You're listening to Wednesday night's Arena as we continue our Arena Olympiad. Tonight we focus on novelists. Shortly we'll hear my interview with Booker Prize winning Australian author Richard Flanagan. But we'll start tonight's show with poet and author Keelan Hughes, who spoke to Sean Rocks about her latest book, The Alternatives. The novel centres on four exceptional adult sisters, Alwyn, Nell, Maeve and Rona Flattery. A geologist, a philosopher, a chef and a political scientist. When Alwyn the eldest goes missing, the sisters must come together to plan a way forward. Let's hear Keelan Hughes' conversation with Sean, which took place in May of this year when The Alternatives was published.
You were talking about the female experience. I was noticing, actually, today I was thinking, Orchid and Wasp, which was the first story, was brother and sister kind of at the heart of it, I suppose, in some ways. Two brothers then at the heart of the wild laughter. Did you feel you owed a group of sisters a chance to have a chat with each other?
I did indeed. I think I needed to practice on the brothers and take one woman at a time before this. But no, It's been fantastic to spend time thinking about sisterhood and I also, you know, I suppose I'm in the trap that I'm writing about adult siblings in all my books so far. Yeah. I think the next one I'll have to look at colleagues or something like that.
Yeah, because I presume your own siblings immediately look and try to work out which ones are them, do they?
They'd have no luck doing that. I don't write that way.
Yeah, well, if you had siblings like this, you'd have a very clever family. These four sisters are one of them more accomplished than the next, it has to be said.
Yeah, so I loved the idea that writing a book about sisters could also be writing a book about women at work. You know, there's a geologist, a philosopher, a political scientist and a chef, and they definitely do walk into a bar. that kind of became inevitable at a certain point. Mm. But yeah, so it was really appealing to me that a book about sisterhood could also be, you know, a book about women expressing themselves through their professions and trying to do meaningful, fulfilling work that gives them, you know, energy and purpose.
And I have to say, I mean, even in the opening section, we find ourselves with Alwyn, who is the eldest of the sisters, and she's the geologist and very interested in climate change, and it allows you to discuss all of that. But we meet her in a lecture scenario, and I have to say the information that you were giving to us in that lecture sounded like a qualified geologist to me. Then we go on and we get some very fine culinary advice from her sister Maeve, some wonderful political analysis from the other sister, Rona, and a bit of philosophy thrown in from the American-based sister Nell. Where did you find all of that knowledge, or was it just sitting there in your head waiting to go on the page, Keelan?
I'm a terrible procrastinator, so I tend to not try and do too much research when I'm writing a novel. Otherwise, I wouldn't write any. You'd be getting one every 20 years out of me. So I tend to write into areas that I'm already interested in. And I'd been particularly interested in geology, I suppose, and geography from a young age, growing up on the west coast of Ireland, and was writing a lot of the book in Connemara, which is just, to me, a really emotionally resonant landscape and one of the most, you know, beautiful landscapes that I know, where you've got this limestone and granite kind of breaching through the fields and these wind-stripped low-lying hills and, you know, colours a painter wouldn't get away with. And it's a wild, dynamic landscape while at the same time being somehow immovable. You know, despite all that weather, it still remains. And there was something in that was a bit like Alwyn, the central character. So maybe something about being there. And there'd been a few geology books that I read over the last decade that left a bit of an impression. Basin and Range by John McPhee is one, and he's actually not a geologist, but it's an extraordinary book. And he says at one point that if he had to restrict the whole book just down to one sentence, the sentence that he'd choose is, "The summit of Mount Everest is marine limestone." And which tells you a lot.
Yeah.
And then there was another book called Notes from Deep Time, A Journey Through Our Past and Future Worlds by Helen Gordon. And that was another book that had made quite an impression. And but actually the chef character was the one I had to do the most research for.
I was going
for.
To ask you that. You know, after you've given me the geological tour of the west of Ireland, when I come to visit you, will I then be getting some very fine local food cooked by you? Because that's what Maeve does. She's not the youngest of them. No, Nell is the youngest, isn't she? Yeah.
Maeve is the second youngest.
Yeah. Yeah, so Maeve is the wonderful culinary. She's kind of an Insta star, really, isn't an Instagram star. This was where you had to do most research.
Yeah, I did, because I'm vegetarian and I'm a very impatient cook. And, you know, if I start cooking, I kind of want to eat within 30 minutes, you know. And so I needed to really try and get into the mind of someone who doesn't think that way about food. Mm. I love food, you know, and I'll happily have someone else prepare it for hours. But I just don't have enough chill. So I actually had to ask a writer friend, you know, mostly because of the fact that she's not a vegetarian, just a vegetarian yeah. chef. So I wanted to be sure that I was writing kind of representatively, yeah. ambitiously for, so I asked a writer friend who was a chef for a long time to look over the recipes, and I ended up having to change some of the starters, which was mad. That all of a sudden, a bit like a painting, you just cut out a few colours or change a few colours, and suddenly the whole thing comes together. Hopefully.
Yeah. Now, I'm not going to ask you where you learned your political analysis and where you learned your philosophy, because the other two sisters give us a section of that. But I guess one of the overriding or overarching shadows in the book is the death of the parents of the four sisters. They were all in their teens, the sisters, when the parents died. Talk to me a little bit about what that gave to you, to the story of this set of siblings.
Yeah, I knew I was setting a novel that would be, I was trying to set it almost exactly when it would be published. I missed by a few months, but I'm set in mid-2023. And so the process of trying to, just the world is changing so rapidly that it felt kind of urgent to set the story as close to now as possible, which meant I had to anticipate what the coming years would be like while trying to capture the current moment. And that process reflected what the novel's about, which is this effort to lurch forward in the story as the carpet's being pulled from beneath our feet. And so these sisters, I think they're maybe more primed for the moment that we're living in than other people, because they did lose their parents early, and they're already familiar with the stages of grief, you know, and they know that the last stage when it comes to the moment that we're in and the climate crisis can't be acceptance. In one way, I was thinking about how we think about the future, the present and the future. And it's just so different to how our parents thought about the future, or really how it was thought about at any point in human history. I think there must be more general pessimism now than ever before. And I'm interested in how individuals respond to that, you know, species-wide phenomenon.
Yeah.
Because there's so many different ways to respond. From denial to retreat to despair to feeling guilt or shame or rage, or to seeking out social support and community connections, to getting involved in more and changing your own behavior and getting involved in change making action. And so the sisters do respond quite differently.
Yeah, and I guess that, again, having a political analyst, a philosopher in the case of Nell, the youngest, and the obviously the geologist and the culinary aspect in there as well, it gives you a chance to discuss those big topics in a character-based way, as opposed to, here comes the message, folks. You know, these people are able to have those type of conversations in quite an easy way. And there I was, reading along from the viewpoints of the various sisters in the opening section of the book. We get, a chapter or section, certainly, from each one of them. And then suddenly I'm reading a two-act play in the middle section of the novel. this is, I mean, it is a classic kind of, the characters come together in an enclosed space and they're kind of trapped there and they have to have their conversations, as it were. How quickly did that form of putting a play essentially in the middle come to you?
Yeah, it was a shock to me too. And it only happened about 3 pages before that section. I write into the dark without a plan, so I never know where a novel's going to go. And I kind of write quite slowly in one draft. So it was about 3 pages before I kind of emailed a friend of mine and I said, oh no, I just have been struck by this image and I think it wants to be a play. Mm. And as soon as I kind of said the words out loud, I knew that there was no other way to write it.
No taking
so it
them back.
No, it was more of an instinct than any kind of artistic or intellectual choice. But it is, in this part of the novel, a family reunion story. And I love a big, messy family gathering story. And, you know, what happens when family comes together is just so much talk and competitive talk and crosstalk and people trying to direct the conversation one way or steer it away from something else. And so I just needed to get out of the character's way, and the play script really allowed me to do that.
Yeah, and of course, for the most part, it's dialogue we're dealing with in the play section of the novel, if you like. I'm wondering about that title, The Alternatives, as well. How alternative are the four Flattery sisters? The Flattery is the family name.
Yeah, and I suppose there was an element of thinking about it as the characters, but I also really liked the alternatives for it, this kind of all-embracing quality it had. It accommodated so many things and it adapted to the story as the story developed. So I couldn't have written this title without any, you know, this book without any, with a different title. There was something about living on the edge of something, living in a way that somehow deemed unusual or tentative, and that there's the promise of change or alternatives to the status quo, you know, some alternative to the kind of sense of inevitability. And so that also the title allowed me to accommodate different modes of storytelling. You know, the fact that there are there's lectures in there, there's Zoom conversations, there's emails, there's the play scripts, there's even like a little excerpt of a philosophy book for children that Nell is composing with her nephew. So it just became this all embracing thing. And at the end, I thought I might have to change it, but there was no other title that could stand in.
There was no alternative, shall we say. The other aspect of that that I thought was interesting in terms of that alternative aspect, as well as those various storytelling forms that you're speaking about, the family units of the four sisters are all very different and certainly not a traditional, none of them traditional family units.
Exactly. Yeah. I suppose at the beginning, when I thought I'm writing four sisters and they all have PhDs, I was simultaneously laughing and just, you know, crying, because I knew that my publisher would just be staring at one another blankly. You know, it's not exactly bestseller material, but I also thought it was quite funny. And one of the PhDs, of course, the chef, hers is honorary, which. She gets the right slagging from the others because of, but there was, so there was the alternatives in the ways that they're living their lives, both, you know, in the family kind of unit, but also in the kind of gig culture that some of their jobs are composed of. And then, so it's a larger thing to do with how we arrange ourselves. So on a personal level, say with that gig economy set up, and maybe the family choices, but also on a community level. If you look at, you know, Maeve, who's living on a houseboat in London, the barge community runs a certain way, and she you know, goes around collecting produce from local farmers and the like in the region. And then kind of arranging how you arrange yourself on a geopolitical level. And so with Rona's work, looking at direct democracy and citizens' assemblies, and, you know, in an earlier iteration, I suppose, of her work, thinking about the North in general and the changes that are happening on this island and on these islands in general. You know, as I was writing the book, everything was changing so quickly. For example, with the Supreme Court's decision around Scotland's second referendum viability and all of that. So that really does seem to those alternative modes of arranging ourselves seemed to be speaking to the moment that I was trying to write about.
Thanks so much for speaking with us this evening, Keelan.
Thank you so much, Sean. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. That's Keelan Hughes talking to us about her third novel, The Alternatives, which is published by One World.
You're listening to Arena.
Viet Thanh Nguyen was born in what was previously known as South Vietnam in 1971. 4 years later, after the fall of Saigon, his family was forced to flee to the United States as refugees, eventually settling in California. His first novel, The Sympathizer, was an ambitious, disturbing book that explored the aftermath of the Vietnam War through the eyes of a Communist Party spy who escaped Saigon for California. The Sympathizer appeared on 30 Best of the Year lists in 2016, won numerous awards, including the Pulitzer Prize, and Nguyen followed it up with a sequel called The Committed. His new title, A Man of Two Faces, is a memoir that traces Nguyen's personal journey with a title drawn directly from the opening line of The Sympathizer. A Man of Two Faces sees Nguyen delve into the core of his being, unravelling the intricacies of his life and exploring the necessity of both remembering and forgetting. Delighted to have Viet Thanh Nguyen join me on the programme this evening. I love the idea that this is as much about forgetting Nguyen as it is about remembering. I think you were, am I right in saying you're perhaps a reluctant memoirist?
Hi, Sean. It's a pleasure to be here with you again. You're absolutely a reluctant memoirist. I think anybody who's an enthusiastic memoirist is a person to be distrusted. I always thought my parents' lives were much more dramatic and interesting than mine because they went through 40 years of war, famine, colonization, and being refugees twice, and all I did was become a writer. So it took me a long time to grapple with my parents' lives and their impact on me. Mm. And the memoir is as much about them as it is about me.
Oh, there you go, robbing my second question on me. It isn't about you. This is about your parents. So thank you for setting that up so well for us. But it strikes me it is about two aspects. Well, it's about loads of aspects, obviously, of your parents' life. But a bit like the remembering and forgetting being part of what the memoir is about, this is as much about really examining everything that your parents did and didn't do and said and didn't say as it is about honouring them, because it quite definitely honours them. But all of those other questions are in there in what you're doing as well.
You know, what I've come to understand both about my own life, but about the lives of many others, of children and grandchildren and people who've undergone terrible things, is that sometimes our parents and grandparents will tell us stories about their past. And those are affecting enough because for many of us, we've been so far removed from these traumatic experiences of an earlier generation. But oftentimes they refuse to speak or they won't speak. And I think that the silences, the absences themselves transmit feeling and emotion, and and at least in my case, left me oftentimes quite confused about who I was and what had happened to my parents, and that absent presence of the past and of unspoken memory, whether my parents didn't remember certain things or whether they refused to remember certain things, whether they just didn't want to share them with me, that really has shaped my life.
In the writing of the book itself, then, did you come to realize that there are certain things that you don't want to remember, or that you can't bring yourself into that space, possibly because it's too difficult a place to go to?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm a writer, but also a scholar. So I certainly know the importance of investigating the past and reconstructing it. And there's a certain element of that in this book, as I talk about the war in Vietnam and its the shaping of a Vietnamese refugee diaspora that I find myself in, and the shaping of my family. However, beyond those historical contours, every family is different. Every family is individual. And what happened to my own family, with my mother in particular, was that she was a wonderful woman who was very successful, but she also went to the mental facilities three times in her life. And I wrote about one of those incidences when I was in college. So I certainly knew about it at the time. I put away that essay, did not look at it again for 30 years until the pandemic. And in the intervening period, I remembered that my mother had gone to this mental facility when I was a little boy. Then I returned to the essay, read it, and realized that was when I was 18 years old. So my own memory had completely distorted what had actually happened, because I think I was so deeply affected by watching my mother in this mental facility. And that gave me the understanding of how how distorting our own memories can be. It's easy to point to someone else and say they've completely changed the past, but in my case, I changed the past. And so I tried to reconstruct certain things, but when my mother returned to that mental facility for the third time about 15 years ago, I could not remember a thing afterwards, and I was a grown adult. Mm. And so I've left certain, I did not try to reconstruct that visit, because sometimes I think that, for me at least, there is a blankness in my memory that has been the effect of this trauma in my family's life. And I want to leave that blank space there, because that's how some of us do experience the past.
For example, I mean, you say that you have no memory of your crossing the ocean, even of that what must have been an incredibly difficult journey for your parents and for you. I know you were very young at the time, but there's nothing there from that period. Do you have a sense that it is in a box that either you or some part of yourself that's looking after you has decided to keep closed, and that you're in agreement with that, or that you just can't go there, or you don't have the facility to actually pick at something and see if it's there?
Yeah, I was actually present at the fall of Saigon, but I was 4 years old, so I wonder if I can be counted as an eyewitness to the fall of Saigon if I actually cannot remember it. And so, yes, we did cross the ocean, and we ended up in a refugee camp in Pennsylvania. And that's where my memories begin, because in order to leave this camp, refugees had to be sponsored by Americans. And there was nobody willing to take all four of us and our family. So I was separated from my parents. And I remember my first memories are of howling and screaming as I'm being taken away. That's where memories begin. And I'm the father of a 4-year-old and a 10-year-old now. And at each of those moments when they turned 4, it was the occasion for me to think about myself and about them. And I think that even if you can't remember your life at 4 years of age, the emotional reverberations that have been taking place around you at 1, 2, 3, 4 years, those do shape you. Those do form, as you said, a box inside of yourself, which you may never be able to tap consciously, but which I strongly believe are there for us unconsciously. And so I do think that I was shaped by that refugee experience, even if I cannot actually remember it.
I don't know if it's fair to talk about secrets in the way you've just described those memories that are, you know, potentially there, but in this box, for whatever reason they're in the box, be that consciously locked away or the subconscious holding them back for our own mental health, perhaps. But you kept secrets from your parents, and your parents kept secrets from you.
Well, the definition of a secret is you don't know it actually exists. So as far as I know, my parents had many secrets from me. You know, when you uncover a secret, then it really isn't that much of a secret anymore. But in my case, certainly I was raised by parents who were devoutly Catholic and devoutly capitalist. And they did their best to turn me into a Catholic capitalist, and it didn't work. You know, I went to Catholic school my entire life, and I turned out an atheist. And my parents were very successful business people, and I turned out a Marxist. And they wanted to have a doctor, and I turned out to be a writer. So, I mean, in many ways, I disappointed my parents, and I tried to, you know, prevent them from feeling as much disappointment as possible by not telling them certain things. So they never learned that I was an atheist, for example. And they never learned that I wanted to be a writer until, in fact, I published The Sympathizer, and then it became public knowledge. So in many ways, I think secrets, you know, can be held for nefarious purposes, for purposes of deception. But sometimes I do believe that we keep secrets from our loved ones in order to protect them as well. And I think probably my parents have protected me with secrets I will never know about. And in turn, and for example, with atheism, did my parents really need to know that I was an atheist? Yeah. That would have really devastated them. So it was perfectly fine to keep that a secret from them, that I was not the son.
I loved that idea that you articulate so well, this idea that it is about protection both ways, a two-way protection. There was an incredible sadness, and even though there was a meeting later on in life, that your parents and indeed the family, as they left Saigon at that time, they had to leave behind their adoptive daughter, who she was a teenager at that time, wasn't she?
She was probably about 16, 15 years old. So what happened was our hometown of Ban Metuit was the first town captured in the final invasion of 1975, and My father was in Saigon. My mother had to make a life and death decision, and she decided to leave with my brother and me and leave behind our adopted sister to take care of the family property, assuming we would come back. But we didn't, obviously, and I would not see her again for 28 years. So obviously I knew who she was. I was 4 years old, but I forgot about her until one day when I was maybe 10 or 11, we get a letter in the mail and it's from her. And there's a picture of this young, beautiful woman. And that was the beginning of my knowledge that we had left somebody behind. And that's another one of those absent presences that I felt haunted my life and shaped me as a writer, because I had to grapple with these absent presences. Mm-hmm. And I think wondering in the back of my mind, what if I had been the one left behind? Okay. And I think that question is a common one for those of us who have been through these kinds of experiences.
And I wonder, as you watch the news today, you know, two particular conflicts spring to mind, obviously the Ukrainian-Russian conflict and the number of people that have had to leave their homes in Ukraine, and also this current situation in Gaza, which has had landed you into a kind of trouble, I think it's fair to say, in late 2023, when you called for a ceasefire along with 750 other writers. And one of an event that you were involved in was cancelled as a direct result of that calling for a ceasefire.
I think it was twofold. I did sign that ceasefire letter, and the institution that cancelled me, a very famous one in New York City, 92NY, which has a very famous writer series, but it's explicitly a Jewish institution. That's a part of its description. But I think the other aspect of it was, in addition to signing that ceasefire letter, I publicly proclaimed on Instagram that I'm still committed to the cause of boycott, divestment, sanctions, BDS, which I had signed on to around 2015 or 2016. And I think that for me, boycott, divestment, sanctions is a nonviolent movement. It's better than violence. And yet the advocates for Israel and Israel itself obviously are intent on suppressing any kind of public disagreement or dissidence with their particular political and military agenda. And I, as an American, feel complicit because our taxes are paying for the billion, literally billions of dollars of weapons and aid that is being sent to Israel to carry out this campaign that has killed 31,000 Gazans, or even by Netanyahu's estimate, 28,000, if you take that number. Mm. And also, you know, we are witnessing a situation where, according to every reliable nonpartisan aid organization, 1.1 million Palestinians are on the brink of famine. And there's enough food outside of Gaza on trucks ready to get in, but Israel will not allow enough aid to arrive. So I think it's a moral and politically urgent scenario. And also as a Vietnamese refugee, I feel for any country that is being bombed by American weapons.
Which I wondered, you know, obviously that's a very strong political standpoint that you've given us on a purely personal level. I don't want to be in any way crass about this, but how triggering or how difficult is it for you to watch the pictures that we see on our television screens on a daily basis? Does that start to trigger memories in any type of way?
I think it's unbelievable to see what we're seeing. And it's not even what we're seeing. I actually have to turn the volume down sometimes because it's actually the hearing of the cries and the parents and the children that I find incredibly affecting as well. And it is triggering because you see some of these images of survivors being pulled out of the rubble, you know, covered with soot and burned and things like this. And of course, again, I was too young to remember this, but I've done a lot of research into the war in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. And you read about what was happening back then, and you read the eyewitness reports, both of Vietnamese people, but also of foreign journalists and aid workers and so on. It's very much the same in terms of the horrors they're describing about being hit by American bombs or American napalm and children being killed or deformed and so on. And so, yes, it is deeply triggering and provocative for me. And so if I'm making strong political statements, it's because I think the situation warrants those statements.
One final question. I mean, there are about 27 final questions I want to ask you, but I just can't do that, unfortunately. You keep, I think, possibly the most repeated phrase in the book is, this is a war story. This is a war story, which you say several times at different points along the way. Why was that aspect of your own life and your own story so important to constantly reiterate for us, the reader?
Two reasons why I think. Number one is that the war in Vietnam killed about 58,000 American soldiers and about 3 million Vietnamese people, the majority of whom were civilians. Do those civilian stories count as war stories? I think they do. You know, I see the damages of war inflicted on my parents and so many other people in the Vietnamese refugee community who are not soldiers at all. And I think that the human consequences of that, of being bombed, of being displaced, of being turned into refugees, of witnessing things being done to other people, these are war stories. And the other reason why I make this claim is because it's very interesting for me to think about when wars begin and when wars end. I think it's a very human impulse to say there has to be a definitive beginning and an end to a war. But in my experience, wars foreshadow other wars, and we don't even know when wars really end, because for Vietnamese refugees and for Americans, even after 1975, I felt the war was not actually over. People were still fighting the war over again in memory. They were deeply traumatized on all sides. And the consequences of that trauma could be very personal for their family members and relatives. But if we look at what happens at the dimension of nation states, America's unworked trauma from the Vietnam War is still having consequences today in the kinds of wars that America chooses to fight and supports.
That civilian aspect of it, of war, goes on and on in the present day.
Wars cannot be contained, and war crimes are not owned by any particular country. Everybody can commit a war crime, and we should always call out war crimes against civilians and children and innocents, no matter who's doing them. And we also have to, unfortunately, have a sense of proportion that 1,200 Israeli dead and 31,000 Palestinian dead have to be held in contrast with each other.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, I really could talk to you for another half hour, but sadly I can't. Thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
That's Viet Thanh Nguyen, and his new book is called A Man of Two Faces. It is published by Corsair.
Richard Flanagan's Booker Prize-winning novel, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, told the story of the Australian prisoners of war who worked on the Death Railroad in Burma during World War II. That book was in part inspired by his father's experience of being slave labour for the Japanese army in that war. Question 7, Flanagan's new non-fiction book, goes back to his father's experience in Japan and counterpoints it with the race in Nazi Germany and among the Allies to develop a bomb so powerful and devastating that it would end the war. Question 7 explores the power of language through a set of chain reactions, a literary love affair between H.G. Wells and Rebecca West, a nuclear physicist inspired by one of Wells's novels, and Richard's own near-death experience on the Franklin River in his native Tasmania. And I'm delighted to be joined by Richard Flanagan. Richard, fans of your Booker winning The Narrow Road to the Deep North will not be unfamiliar with references in question 7 to the Japanese prisoner of war camps. But this is a book of non-fiction, while The Narrow Road to the Deep North was fiction. It's really ostensibly a memoir, but it's very unconventional. Did you set out for it to be a memoir, or did you have bigger questions and bigger fish to fry?
Look, I think I was, maybe I was Ishmael, and I ended up looking for a white whale. It's a book about the choices, really, we make about love and life and the consequences of those decisions. And it's also about how we cannot be what we cannot dream, and we actually live in the dreams of others. And it's how a book begat a world, which in turn begat another book, and which leads me here today to be talking to you. And it really begins, I guess, with a kiss in an Edwardian drawing room, and by over a century ago, and leads by a circuitous route to my childhood in a very remote mining town in a vast ancient rainforest on the west coast of Tasmania. And I guess it's a sort of love letter to both my island home and my now my long dead parents.
Yes, and it does all that. Let's get the title of the book, Question 7, out of the way first. Where does it come from, and what does it mean?
Well, it comes from a very early Chekhov story written by the great Russian master when he was starting out writing humorous sketches. And it was a parody of those sort of mental arithmetic questions asked of school children. And what he did in this little sketch was turn them on their heads with a non sequitur. So Chekhov's original question 7 goes like this: Wednesday, June the 7th, a train had to leave station A at 3 a.m. in order to reach station B at 11 p.m. Just as the train is about to depart, however, an order comes that it must arrive at station B by 7 p.m. Who loves longer, a man or a woman? And it's just a joke, but in a sense it's a joke that cuts to the heart of the matter, which is, why do we do what we do to each other? Who does love longer? How to live? What is it to live? The way in which we think we live in a world of timetables and numbers, and that is our reality. And in that very early sketch, you get all the greatness of Chekhov's later stories, which begin ostensibly in the reality of a dinner party or a doctor visiting someone, and then suddenly you fall through this void into this other world, which seems less real, but is actually the true world that matters to us, that pulses thick and hard through our wrist, and that's the world of what it is to live and how to live. And I guess the book is really written trying to understand how in an indifferent universe people who are too easily dismissed as everyday find meaning and make an answer to the horror of this world. And I thought more and more about my parents and how they did it through their acts of kindness and goodness and their stories and jokes and asserting an idea of love. And they practiced that love and defended that love and lived that love. And when I was younger, I thought it was an illusion. But over time, they turned that illusion into a truth and that truth into a reality. And I guess it was a form of magic, and they, the magicians. And I thought, again, when I was younger, that they were naive to think their love might make a difference. But when I was writing this book, I realised the naivety was mine alone.
Yes, because they had such hard lives, and in your father's case, this tragic life of having worked as a slave in the Japanese prisoner of war camps, that when they came back and were together and had a family, I presume that they could see priorities that maybe a young boy couldn't see, or a love that the importance of love from what they had come from.
I think what they saw was that certain things mattered and most things didn't, and that material things and a world of ambition, possessions, that these things weren't important. And what ultimately mattered was your capacity for kindness and goodness. I think we live in a world now where, you know, there's so much despair now, and it is because we're encouraged to take our compass from power. And, you know, power is always with us, but its wages are horror. And if we only look at power, we will live in despair, whereas if we look at the reality of our lives, at our friends and our family, complex and difficult as it often and mostly is, it's also a source of endless hope, because there is goodness and kindness to be found there. Now, and I guess that's what I saw in my parents' lives.
Yes, and it is your parents' lives in the book that provide that sense of hope. But to go back to what you were talking about, this love affair, this meeting in an Edwardian room between H.G. Wells and Rebecca West, and a book by H.G. Wells having a huge effect on a physicist who was engaged in looking for the secret of how to create this bomb that would end all wars. Tell us about Leo Szilard and H.G. Wells and how they're connected.
Well, what happens is that Wells meets Wells, a middle-aged man, meets a young Rebecca West, then 18, in his drawing room in London in 1911, and they quickly begin a passionate affair, and they kiss in front of his bookcase, and Wells, who was famously a proponent of free love, ran away in terror. And he was terrified because she just didn't want sex. She wanted the whole package. And Wells fled he had a complex love life. He fled to his mistress's chalet in Switzerland, where he wrote a book which envisaged a weapon of complete and mass destruction. And that weapon was founded in the latest science, the discoveries about radium. But Wells foresaw so much more than the scientists, and he was trained in science, and he could see the possibilities implicit in the science, and he invented this weapon called an atomic bomb. The book he wrote wasn't very good, and it was a book that he wrote in flight from love, and he invented in his rejection of that love an idea of mass destruction. And 20 years later, a young Jewish refugee physicist who had fled Hitler's Germany, read this book, and crossing the traffic lights at Southampton Row in London, just near the British Museum, the book inspired him to have a vision of a nuclear chain reaction, which at that point no one had ever conceived. And that was the great theoretical breakthrough that enabled the building of the atomic bomb. And Szilard also saw, because he was a scientist of brilliance, but also one with a moral imagination and a political imagination. And he recognised that the likely country to first invent a bomb would be Germany, and that if Hitler got the bomb, he would enslave the world. And so in the late 30s, he enlists Einstein to petition Roosevelt to begin an atomic bomb program to forestall the Nazis getting the bomb. And that leads to the Manhattan Project, that leads to the bomb dropping on Hiroshima and then on Nagasaki, the hundreds of thousands of dead. And in consequence, ironically, and this is one of the great ironies of my life, my father, who was near death and who would have died if the war dragged on for a few months more, as it was going to without the bomb, my father, who was a prisoner 80 miles south of Hiroshima, he lived, and all those innocent people died in that great crime. And because of that bomb, because of the novel that H.G. Wells wrote, I'm here talking to you today. And so, you know, it's often said, quoting Auden, that poetry makes nothing happen. But it is also the case that a novel destroyed Hiroshima. And so I think the book is about how we so often live in other stories of which we're unknowing about, and we need to think more carefully about the stories we tell and try and tell better stories in the hope that we might live better.
Yes, because though H.G. Wells was not a scientist, what he said in the book inspired this physicist to get that hunch, and the hunch was the idea that led to the chain reaction, which led to the notion of what created the Manhattan Project.
That's right.
And obviously, H.G. Wells had no idea that he had that connection with the bomb, did he?
He was aware that he'd predicted it. He wasn't aware of the connection with Szilard, although he'd actually met Szilard prior to this. But Szilard makes it very clear in his writings at the time and subsequently of his debt to Wells's novel, and that it is Wells's vision that haunts him, and it's Wells's vision that inspires him to come up with this vision and then the theory of the nuclear chain reaction.
The other very interesting part of your book is that your family are from Tasmania, and that you go back into the history of Tasmania, first of all the colonisation and really the genocide of the Aboriginal people there, and then there's a lot about the convicts, which of course would be very pertinent for Irish readers and listeners, the convict island that was Van Diemen's land back then. And you talk a lot about how the convicts were dealt with or were considered by the other people who lived on the island.
Tasmania, or Van Diemen's Land as it was known, was the gulag of the British Empire. But more than that, the system there was modelled on the Caribbean plantation slave system. And it was a totalitarian slave society. And my forebears were all Irish people sent out during the famine for various crimes, sometimes stealing food, sometimes political crimes. But this was a huge trauma to be part of a slave system, because you were not only the slave, but you were the enslaver. You know, that there were convict flagellators, convict hangmen, convict constables, convict clerks. And this trauma, which is a quarter of the island's modern history, remained deeply buried in the psyche of the Tasmanian people. And Tasmania has remained to this day the poorest and most backward of all the Australian states. It's remote from Australia, 400 kilometres away. And it has a second trauma that it has to deal with, which is the near successful genocide of the Tasmanian Aboriginal people, a war of extermination, as it was called at the time, that was waged with a great and pitiless brutality by the British authorities. And after those two traumas, most of the people in Tasmania to this day are descendants of either the convicts or the Aborigines or a mix of both. And there is a haunting of the island in consequence, and there is much that has never been named or said which needs to be named or said. And I wanted to try and understand myself, to ask questions of myself about what that means for the way I might write and conceive of my world. And I try and address some of that in the book. Because I guess, you know, if you're listening to this in Kerry or Sligo or Dublin or wherever, you may think that Tasmanians are Western people like the Irish, that we are similar. But the reality is we were changed by these experiences. We became different. There is an idea of colonisation, that it destroys everything. It does destroy much, but equally in my island, there was a reverse river that ran through it, and that was that people took on many of the values, the ways of thinking, the mentality of the Indigenous people, and there was this reverse river of Indigenisation and ideas of time, of space, of clan, family, of the relationship to the land, which were Indigenous, took hold amongst the ex-convicts. And it didn't make them Indigenous, but it made them different. But people never named what that difference was. And I think sometimes it falls to others to try and find the words for these differences. And that was one of the tasks I felt I had in writing this book, to try and understand something of that difference.
Another event that you endeavour to come to terms with here is what happened to you on the Franklin River when you were just 21. It is so wonderfully written. It is like the most dramatic cliffhanger of a piece of writing anybody will ever read. So I don't want to go into the event as such, because I'm sure it is a very painful event to recall and have written. But what what made you feel that it was this book that you should? I know you made attempts before to write about it in books, but that you did it so vividly and comprehensively in this book.
Because one of the ideas, because the book is about, as I was saying at the beginning, about, I think during that long dark night of COVID, people became more and more concerned with the question of what is it to live, how to live. And you see that in the wake of COVID and everything from the so-called Great Resignation in the West to the Lie Flat movement in China, people trying to assert some better idea of what life might be, to find some more meaning in their life. And I thought about how when my father survived the horrors of those prisoner of war camps and returned, he told me how he travelled round the island, going to its beaches and forests and rivers, and sitting in the small pinched kitchens of his family, drinking tea from the cracked teapots, and feeling within all those things the immense love of others. And that sense that this, what it was to live, that this love was what life was. And when I had this experience that I describe in the book, after it, I felt that I had the most extraordinary sensations that I was of the earth and belonged to it. And these sensations never really left me. And I wanted to touch the earth and to be with people, because I realised that whatever meaning there is in this world, it doesn't exist in yourself. It exists in others. And ever after that, I never really cared much about ambition, material things. I simply cared about being with others. And it's that where I find my meaning. And so I found, I guess when I thought about it, I saw in my father's experience my own, and in my own, my father's. And I guess the book is a mirroring of the two.
Thank you so much. Richard Flanagan's new book is Question 7, and it's out now, and it's published by Chatto and Windus.